Michael Goldfarb in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The treatment of prisoners in U.S. military custody since the war on terror was proclaimed continues to provoke questions legal, moral, and journalistic, sometimes all three. Last week, revelations in the Wall Street Journal and Washington Post that memos exist in which the legal framework for interrogation techniques were analyzed set in motion a further debate about just how far interrogators have been allowed to go in getting information from prisoners in Guantanamo Bay, Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, and Iraq. The decision by Attorney General John Ashcroft to keep the memos secret only added interest to the story. Connection listeners, what does the existence of the memos tell us about the Bush administration's position on torture? And the president says the war on terror is like no other. Should the legally binding frameworks of the Geneva Convention even apply? Do the revelations of harsh interrogation techniques in Guantanamo and at Abu Ghraib actually put American soldiers at risk? 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK is the number to call to join in the conversation. And I'm joined on the telephone now by Jess Braven, who's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and whose story, I guess it was exactly a week ago, Jess, was it?
That's right.
Was the first to reveal that these memos exist. Now, could you just bring us up to date on what's happened since then?
Sure. There have been a few more drips and drabs of revelations about what's actually going on in these various detention facilities at the United States operates and what has gone on since late 2001. But mainly there's been a pushback from the government to insist that despite the fact that they were exploring some of these legal doctrines, they aren't actually torturing anybody. That's been their message for the past week.
Now, the memos themselves, you've had a chance to look at some of them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what's your view? I mean, are these merely policy advisory positions written by the chief White House counsel to his number one and only client, explaining what the scope of authority he has to, you know, order certain kinds of interrogation techniques to be used? Or do you think that they're actually policy statements?
Well, I think that since 9/11, there has been a debate, not within the Bush administration, because it's sort of solved within there, but more broadly, about whether when we say 9/11 changed everything, that had specific legal implications for the way that the government operates and the way that individuals' rights are understood. And these memos are all quite consistent in extrapolating what it means to say that 9/11 changed everything. It changed the legal framework, the legal paradigm that the government operates under in the view of the people who wrote it. So if you start with that premise, then these aren't so much advocacy documents as they are explorations of what that means.
Explorations of what that means, but their use. I mean, I think the reason that people are interested in this is that I think that readers, whether they read your reporting originally in the Journal or in People's following in your intrepid footpaths, would say, well, okay, it is leading to a very specific decision-making process. Was that your reading of them?
Well, sure. I mean, you could ask yourself, you know, why is it that the top lawyers at the Pentagon and the White House and elsewhere are asking themselves, how would it be lawful to commit acts that otherwise are criminal? And in fact, one of the sections of the memo we reported last week is actually titled that. It says, in fact, I'll just read here, legal doctrines under the federal criminal law that could render specific conduct otherwise criminal, not unlawful. You know, and that's sort of an unusual topic of advice to have the top officials of the country be considering.
Right.
And then, you know, they go forward to lay out specific ways that, you know, criminal conduct could be understood to be not criminal. And, for example, they talk about the defense that was employed by the Nazi war criminals at Nuremberg. And, I mean, it's startling because generally Americans tend to identify more with the prosecution at Nuremberg than the defense.
Yes. Now, just this is a small point, but it's a detail. There's two memos we're talking about here. One comes through the Justice Department. One comes through the Department of Defense.
Well, there actually are a series going back to late 2001. For example, in December of 2001, the Justice Department was opining on the legal implications of storing non-citizens at Guantanamo as opposed to, say, Midway Island and Wake Island in the Pacific. And the reason this was an issue is because the rights that somebody has depends on where they are and where they were born. So this was a memo that laid out a theory that said that if foreigners were held at Guantanamo Bay, they would not have the same legal protections that they would if they were at Wake Island or Midway Island, because those islands in the Pacific are by statute included under the jurisdiction of the federal court in Hawaii, which would make it much easier for them to get some review of their conditions in a federal court. So all these things are in a sense of a piece. We haven't found any coming from any department other than the State Department that suggest a contrary thrust of reasoning.
Okay. Now, just because the Attorney General was asked last week to simply make public these memos, he's declined. Today, the Washington Post has put one of the memos up online at WashingtonPost.com, so they're sort of out there.
Mm-hmm.
During the course of the week, do you expect the pressure to continue on Attorney General Ashcroft to make all of these things public?
Well, traditionally, legal advice from lawyers to clients is confidential. The idea is that you know, lawyers might explore things such as the possibility that the client is guilty and what that might mean legally, that you don't want to be discussing in public, and you certainly don't want to let your legal adversary know what strategy or doctrines you might be deciding to rely upon. So traditionally, lawyer advice is confidential, and the government has often refused to release what they call pre-decisional documents, documents that reflect the discussions that are going on within the halls of power. And they say that if everything they were thinking about were public, it would interfere with their frank discussion of interesting ideas. But this is a little different, because the ideas that are being discussed are so unusual, and they reflect so much upon the broader identity of the country, and they reflect so directly upon the public statements that many government officials were making, that I think the pressure will still be there. I mean, for instance, when it comes to the torture question, while government lawyers privately were concluding that the president had the inherent authority to simply disregard the United Nations Convention Against Torture and domestic laws that implement it, publicly they were citing that very treaty as the basis for their treatment of prisoners at Guantanamo, and insisting that they fully intend to comply, or rather act consistent with its requirements. So the question is, you know, which is it? I mean, is there a legal duty to honor these treaties, or is the legal duty somewhat more porous?
Well, let me take that point, Jess, and throw that question to one of our other guests who's been waiting patiently on the line, and he is David Rifkin, who is a partner at the law firm of Baker and Hostetler in Washington, D.C., and he also worked for both the Reagan and the first Bush administrations. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
Now, you've just heard Jess explaining these things. What do you say to that?
Well, I think what he sketched out is basically correct. Unfortunately, the nuances get lost in a lot of media coverage. It is quite common for government lawyers, or any lawyers for that matter, to first, before you make a policy cut, before you really make policy decisions, to explore the legal parameters. Let's call them the outer parameters of what's possible. And you typically do it in a very candid, advocacy-oriented fashion. To me, the fact that those questions were asked in the aftermath of September 11 is both necessary and appropriate. Look, most countries in the world, including many democracies, would not have even bothered asking what are the legal parameters or what's possible. So these were legal memos, and actually, to clarify slightly your question, these were exquisitely clearly legal memos. There was no policy advice. There was no policy guidance. And we know that as a matter of policy, the administration decided properly, in my opinion, not only not to engage in torture, but not even to engage in inhumane treatment. So These memos sketch out the outer parameters of what's possible using, frankly, some very aggressive arguments.
Okay.
But
that,
the policy decision was not to go anywhere close to the line, and that's the point but a lot of people, unfortunately, don't understand.
All right. Well, let me bring into the conversation now our other guest for the hour, who is Scott Silliman, professor of law at Duke University, executive director of the Center on Law, Ethics, and National Security at Duke, and who spent 25 years in the Air Force in the Judge Advocates Corps. There. Hello, Scott.
Good morning, Michael.
Now, in your time in the military, if you had come across a memo like this, if it had crossed your desk, would you have thought it was no more than exploring ideas, or would you have seen it as, if not directly stating policy, at least indicating what the parameters of policy are likely to be?
Well, Michael, I take a different view of the series of memos than David does. I view these all as attempts to craft a legal regime with a purpose of evading not only domestic law but international law in how we interrogate those captured in the war on terrorism. It is not just exploring options. The central thread running from the original theory set out by John Yoo in early 2002, is that the president, in a war, the war on terrorism, is not to be constrained, cannot be constrained by either domestic or international law, because his decisions on the types of tactics used in interrogation are akin to battlefield decisions. That theory is sweeping and breathtaking in its implication for presidential authority. But again, these memos are more to shield those that are conducting interrogations from criminal prosecution more than anything else. So I take a different view than David.
Jess, just so we can be clear on this, we're talking about these memos which were prepared. It's a sequence of them, but the main one that I'm going to refer to in a minute is August 2002, long before the war in Iraq. There is a difference here in what we're talking about, is there not, between what happens in Iraq at Abu Ghraib, which is where the whole story really blew up, and what's happening in Guantanamo and at Bagram in Afghanistan.
That's right, because early on the Bush administration concluded that what it styles the global war on terrorism is not constrained by the Geneva Conventions, which reflect, in their view, as we saw in one memo, a quaint view of 20th century warfare that involves nation states with armies on a battlefield firing cannons at each other. And they say that model isn't appropriate when you're dealing with a global SMERSH-like terrorist network that doesn't play by those rules. So right early on, they said those don't apply. Now, it gets confusing because they have said that the Iraq war is more of a conventional war where the Geneva Conventions do apply. However, the same people prosecuting the Iraq war also are involved in the global war on terrorism, including General Miller, who's come over to Iraq after heading the Guantanamo operation. So it's not surprising if some of the lines get blurred by soldiers who have to carry out the policy in the field.
Jess, I want to thank you very much for joining us, and I know you've got to go back out and chase this story down a bit more. We'll look for your reports in the Wall Street Journal in the week ahead. Connection listeners, we're talking about the legal framework for a hard and intensive interrogation. Some call it torture, some call it abuse. Some say the president has set up a framework that allows the military to be within the law in using these techniques. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, the number to call. Tell us what you think. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. We're talking in this hour, Connection listeners, about the treatment of prisoners in U.S. military custody since the war on terror was proclaimed. We're wondering, do the revelations of harsh interrogation techniques in Guantanamo and at Abu Ghraib actually put American soldiers at risk? And we're also asking what the legal framework is for this. The president certainly was given legal advice. I'm joined in this hour by David Rifkin, who's a Washington lawyer who served both President Reagan and in the first Bush administration, and with Scott Silliman, who's professor of law at Duke University and a retired member of the Judge Advocates Corps. He was in the Air Force for 25 years. Gentlemen, both of you, I just want to read the memo of August 1st, 2002, which is clearly the one that most reflects the full range of thinking or legal advice being given to the president. It was written by Alberto Gonzalez, his chief counsel. On page 38 says, one of the core functions of the commander-in-chief is that of capturing, detaining, and interrogating members of the enemy. And then about five lines redacted. And then the next page, any effort by Congress to regulate the interrogation of battlefield combatants would violate the Constitution's sole vesting of the commander-in-chief authority in the president. Scott, is that reasonable, a good reading of the existing law, do you think?
I don't think it is, Michael. Again, you have to bridge certain hurdles to get there. One is you've got to suggest that the war on terrorism is exactly the same as a traditional declared war, such as World War II, the last declared war we had. And secondly, you've got to say that the interrogation tactics and the gathering of information to preclude attacks are just like, as I said before, a tactical commander's battlefield decision. Now, if you go across both those hurdles, it is true that the courts have recognized the commander-in-chief's role in the field of battle and given him total discretion. I don't think we can go that far. And I think it's worth noting, Michael, that in a working group meeting in the Pentagon just last year, where many of these theories that we've been talking about were brought to the table for the purpose of crafting a memo for approval by Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, many of the military attorneys there balked at applying these principles, even at Guantanamo Bay, for fear that the precedent we set would put our own servicemen in jeopardy years to come. And I totally agree with that.
David, how do you – that's one of the key points that's made over and over again since the story about prisoner abuse broke, that the application of hard interrogation techniques – don't send me emails, connection listeners, call it torture if you like. We're just using synonyms here that these hard interrogation techniques, actually for the information that might be extracted, when you weighed it against the risk to serving soldiers in the field, wasn't worth it.
I don't agree with this assertion, and let me tell you why. Let me tell you first, I don't think that we should engage in torture and inhumane practices. Legal issues aside, I think there are some things we cannot do without losing our soul, if you will, without losing the essence of our society, nor can we do that, as this whole controversy shows. Having said that, I think the restrictions are really mostly ethical, mostly moral, and mostly unilateral, because, again, I happen to think that the law is actually perhaps not as permissive as some of his memos suggest, but not as restrictive as the administration's critics say. But on the issue of impact on the treatment of American POWs, let's be honest. American POWs, unfortunately, tragically, have been tortured and brutalized in every single conflict. They've been killed. We lost, if you look at the statistics, we lost something like 2,600 POWs died in Korean POW camps. I mean, everybody who's seen a movie about Vietnam War can go talk to Senator McCain, who remembers the target cages. American POWs were brutally mistreated in the first Gulf War, and even in the second Gulf War. We're dealing with people who have absolutely, unfortunately, no regard for Geneva Convention, and these were POWs. Having said that, I don't think that we should do anything that any technique. But let's not kid ourselves. I remember this very emotional statement by Senator Biden about my son is in the military. Conceding his sincerity, he's just factually wrong. Our people get tortured and killed because of the nature of adversaries we're fighting against. So reciprocity to me is not a big issue. But again, it doesn't mean that we should engage in torture and inhumane practice.
Scott,
my bottom line, though, is we should be willing and able to use measured application of stress techniques, things that don't arise to that level, but do provide for aggressive interrogation opportunities. Because for us not to do that makes no policy sense and certainly does not make any legal sense.
Scott?
Well, Michael, I think if David is correct, then that logically leads to an abandonment of all international conventions on the regulation of prisoner of war treatment and everything else, and I don't think anyone would agree with that. What we have tried to do since World War II is to build up a body of international law, international humanitarian law, under the fundamental premise that there are some things, even in conflict, that are not permissible. Now, I think it's important, again, to stress that this is not a unanimous view, that if the military attorneys, those in uniform, could sit where I sit right now, Michael, and be on this microphone, I think they would share a great concern, but they cannot speak because they are servants of the sovereign. So I am greatly concerned that if, in fact, we take the view that because the other side, the enemy, as it were, violates the conditions of international law, the Geneva Conventions and whatever, that gives us the right to either suspend them or set them aside ourselves. And in doing so, Michael, we become just as those who we claim to be our enemy.
I just want to pick up that point with both of you, is that it often, this is particularly about war on terror. The war against to overthrow Saddam was almost more conventional. It was like a declaration, we're going to remove him for failure to do certain things, and it happened. But the very vagueness of the concept of war on terror, it seems to me, doesn't it put it outside any kind of body of law? The body of law, for example, that Scott Silliman was referring to, David.
Well, Michael, let me say a couple of things. I mean, we could have a debate about whether laws applicable to armed conflict apply here, but let me, I think, far more important point that we need to understand. Nobody's advocating suspending or evading Geneva Conventions. There is the gold standard, the POW standard, that applies under the Geneva Convention. With all due respect, it debases law just as much. If you do not give the people the rights they're entitled to, if you treat POWs below the gold standard, it debases law just as much to give unlawful combatants POW standard. That makes absolutely no sense. And if you do that, throughout the history of law of armed conflict, there's always been a connection between how you behave prior to capture and how many rights you get after capture. If you're going to treat everybody the same, if everybody gets that gold standard, you're providing no incentives to people not to kill civilians, not to engage in deliberate attacks on the civilian targets. You have just erased, Scott, centuries and centuries of law in this area. Now, it doesn't mean that you should torture or treat inhumanely unlawful combatants, but you can interrogate them in much more aggressive ways than you can POWs. And that's not evasion. That's called complying with the law requires, not doing more than
David,
the law requires.
David, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just want to go to the phones. 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK is the number to call. And Lou is calling from Buffalo, New York.
Yeah, hi. I guess just an observation. I think we have to – this is the United States of America. You know, our laws – we're governed by the Constitution. And in that, I think – we want to try to hold on to somewhat of a higher plane. And, you know, I mean, we're talking about, I mean, the torture or how we're dealing with prisoners. I mean, what goes around comes around. We, you know, our soldiers are out there. The grunts are in they're in the front line of battle. We got to be concerned what happens to them when they're taken prisoner. And sure, I respect what the one gentleman was saying, that so many have been. But that's what the Geneva Convention and international laws like that are set up for. Those are the standards that we can at least call out to the enemy to say, hey, these are our people. Treat them right. That's all I have to say.
Lou, thanks for that. Scott, what do you say to that?
Well, I totally agree with Lou, Michael. And let me point out that, again, we're dealing with international and domestic law, which has, at least in theory, a basis in fundamental morality. I do, though, want to express a concern. David was talking about, well, we would never want to suspend the application of the Geneva Conventions. Well, in a memo written by the Office of Legal Counsel to the Department of Defense in January 2002, it says exactly that, and I'm reading, as a constitutional matter, the President has the power to consider performance of some or all obligations of the United States under the Convention suspended. That is troubling to me, Michael, and I think that's the concern. Now, I think the Attorney General was probably correct when he testified last week and said there was no direct linkage between any of these memos and what happened at Abu Ghraib. I would suggest there may at least be an indirect linkage, and that should be of concern to us.
The necessity defense is a phrase that comes up in the August 1st, 2002 memo. And just to say again, Connection listeners, if you're at your desk, you can go to our website, theconnection.org. We have a link to this memo. You can read it. It's a long one. It's about 50 pages. But it is very interesting to see what the legal thinking at the White House is about the scope for the legal scope for allowing hard interrogations to go on. David, necessity defense means essentially that out of necessity, any pre-existing laws, the Geneva Conventions, anything the U.S. is signatory to can be suspended out of necessity, right?
That's what it says, but I would submit to you, and this is not trying to avoid your question, Michael, the far more important issue is not debating whether Geneva Convention can be suspended and whatever merits of OSCE's legal analysis, but to ask ourselves a question. What do we have in the middle? We have two dogmatic positions. On the one side, we have people who would say anything goes. On the other side, we have people, and I'm afraid Scott fits in that category, which says nothing goes. And I would submit to you there's a variety of aggressive interrogation techniques that do not amount to torture, if you look at the definition of it, do not amount to inhumane treatment, that can and should be used. You know, for example, I hate to get specific because it's not a cheerful subject, but I want to ask Scott one question. If you've gone for basic training, where your sergeant tells you to give him 200 push-ups and puts you at parade rest for a couple of hours. That technique gets used during the hell week, which is last week in Marine training. You get about 4 or 5 hours of sleep. If we do it to our own people in an effort to mold them into soldiers, to break down some civilian habits, are you telling me that we cannot do at least that much to unlawful combatants whom we capture?
David, I would respond that with regard to those instances you cite, obviously not, and that's clearly not what we're talking about when we're looking at those specific procedures that were authorized by the Department of Defense, Secretary Rumsfeld, for Guantanamo Bay. And I think we should all recognize, Michael, that as you started out in your lead-in, these techniques and all these memos were clearly meant to apply to Guantanamo Bay interrogations, where the President of the United States determined that the Geneva Conventions, as to all those down there, do not apply. The problem, I think, is that when General Miller went to Iraq to intensify and increase the productivity of interrogations in that country, where the conventions clearly do apply, that we, in fact, have seen some leaching of those techniques into the culture of the interrogators or the military intelligence folks at Iraq. And that is the problem, I think, that will ultimately come out in all these hearings and the articles by Jess and his colleagues. But nonetheless, we need to go back and ensure that David is correct, that these memos, the great number of them, and many will probably come out later, are only for the purpose of exploring options, because I don't read them that narrowly.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Richard is calling from Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hello.
I just wanted to state that I don't believe that this is even applicable. Do these laws not apply to persons or the countries that are signatories of the document?
Which document are you referring to?
The Geneva Conventions.
Geneva Conventions.
Yeah, I mean, if I may, that's David. Absolutely right. Of administration early on determined, and I don't think it's unobjectionable to Scott or most lawyers, that Al-Qaeda is an organization that, by definition, is not a signatory to the Geneva Conventions, and the Geneva Convention does not apply to Al-Qaeda. As far as Taliban is concerned, the logic gets a little more complicated, but the administration concluded that the Geneva Convention, well, they actually went back and forth, but determined that Geneva Conventions did apply to Taliban, but Taliban, given the fact that it did not comply with the so-called four criteria for lawful combatancy, were nevertheless not captured Taliban members, were not POWs. That logic had nothing to do with interrogation. techniques number grave, and that logic is exactly right. One point about the caller. Unfortunately, of a lot of people who, instead of looking at these documents as something that grants specific benefits to the people who sign them, take a far more dogmatic view and say those documents establish principles that bind every government at all times, even with regard to parties who have not signed them. And that is, of course, not a serious argument as a matter of traditional international law.
Is that right, Scott? Is it not a serious argument?
Well, I'm going to agree with David as far as his explanation with regard to the conventions applying in Afghanistan as the president determined, but that neither the Taliban nor members of al-Qaeda are to enjoy the protections. I think the president is clearly right as far as al-Qaeda. I would question a little bit more the determination on the Taliban, and I would have suggested, as Colin Powell suggested, that we employ the mechanism of the Geneva Convention, what's called an Article 5 screening tribunal, to determine if any of those folks down there are in fact entitled to prisoner of war status. As a matter of fact, when you look at the review procedures now being implemented by the Department of Defense for annual review of detention of those in Guantanamo Bay, they bear a striking relationship to what's called the Article 5 screening tribunals. Now, there are other international laws, though, Michael, that apply, and one of them is the International Convention on Torture. That is not constrained by anything by presidential determination. Interestingly, though, the United States, when it implemented the Torture Convention, said that it only applies within the United States, and that, therefore,
Okay.
It applies only outside the United States, and that's totally contrary to the argument being made by the Supreme Court when the Supreme Court in the detention issue at Guantanamo Bay said that they are outside the scope of the United States, but in
Scott
took a different position.
I'm sorry to interrupt you for a second. I just want to quickly go back to Richard in Baton Rouge. We're coming to the end of the segment. Richard, did you have a comment on what you've just heard?
Yes, I do. Let's address the issues with Abu Ghraib. Again, you have a situation with stateless combatants. They're basically terrorists. And you're talking about the fact that these persons were allegedly tortured. I'm going to be quite frank with you. I saw the pictures. I've seen the pictures on the Internet. I was hazed. I'm in my 40s. I was hazed worse in a fraternity than those guys.
Okay, Richard, I want to thank you for your call. Thank you for your comments. We're coming back to this subject after the break, Connection listeners. We're talking legally about what's been going on to detainees, prisoners in U.S. custody from Guantanamo to Afghanistan, and as you just heard, via Abu Ghraib. Differences in all cases, but let's try and clarify them with your questions. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, the numbers to call. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. We're talking in this hour about the law and torture, particularly meaning captives of America since 2001. We're talking about this subject with Scott Silliman, professor of law at Duke University, and David Rivkin, who is a partner at the law firm of Baker and Hostetler in Washington, D.C., and a veteran of both the Reagan and Bush administrations. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, the number to call. Jerry is calling from Nashville, Tennessee.
Yes. My question is more central than all of that. Is the commander-in-chief, as the commander-in-chief, above the civil law of America, which conforms to the Geneva Convention voluntarily, or is the commander-in-chief not subject to the civil laws of America? Just because he's the commander-in-chief, does that mean he no longer works for the civilians? If he no longer works for the civilians, then let's have, like no-bid contracts.
Hold on. I mean, basically what you're asking is, does his authority as commander-in-chief mean that he's essentially got a different relationship to the civil laws in society?
Exactly.
Okay, Jerry, stay there. I'm going to put that question first to David Rivkin.
Well, the short answer is this. The Constitution is a supreme law of this country. As you know well, in a number of instances, if Congress enacts legislation that runs afoul of the Constitution, it's void, it's null, and doesn't mean that anybody is above the law. All it means is that the specific laws passed by Congress have to conform to the Constitution. Now, specifically, regarding the President's Commander-in-Chief power, it is a very awesome power, it's a plenary power, it's complete power. Does that give a president the right to disregard, for example, a specific congressional ban on torture, which is indeed the case in the form of a legislation implementing the Torture Convention? It is a complex question. What I at least would say is this. The closer you get to the battlefield situation, the more difficult is a constitutional issue, because then you really are in the area that is very plenary. And therefore, what to say plenary means cannot be trenched by Congress. The further away you get from the battlefield, the more difficult it is to take this position. So,
is that for, by the way, let me just interrupt you, David. Is that distance from the battlefield temporal as well as physical? Because, of course, one of the things about Guantanamo is that these guys were scooped up in October and November of 2001. They're coming up on 3 years in custody without being charged. I mean, distance from the battlefield is also something that comes in, yes, in time, too, yes?
Yes. That is, again, the closer, to give me a very brief scenario, if you are trying to govern, and we all agree Congress cannot do that, how a particular squad can advance on the hill held by the enemy. Congress can't pass a law which says you can only, outflank the enemy on the right but not on the left. It would be absurd. And if you were talking about the way a surgeon or, a junior officer leading that platoon interrogates a captured enemy, this is in the president's power. It's its highest ambit. If we're talking about, Michael, the situation where you are hundreds of miles behind the lines on your side and it's months away, it is more difficult. I personally would not support that broad of reading of presidential power, but these are not entirely legitimate arguments. But very
Scott,
important for your listeners to appreciate, doesn't mean you're above the law. The issue really is, what is the law here?
Scott, just come on in.
Well, I do agree with David as far as his analysis on the closer you get to the technical battlefield decision-making, that is within the sole province of the president. And I think you're exactly touching upon it, Michael, is where do interrogations of prisoners fit in or detainees? And if the war on terrorism is to go on forever, will this authority of the president go on forever? You know, there is one point, though, that is not actually legal, but the question needs to be asked, are we getting credible information? David mentioned the abuse of our prisoners in Vietnam. If there's one thing I think we learned from at least anecdotal evidence out of Vietnam, it's that people will say anything to stop the pain. So are we getting or are we assured of getting credible information?
There's another example you would use, which is particularly in the case of Al-Qaeda, which we know is organized in cells, operating independently and without knowledge of one another, rather on the model of the IRA, is that once you have been detained, then the central, whatever central authority there is, immediately changes all operational details based on what they know you know, because they assume that you're going to give it up under torture anyway.
So your information becomes outdated very quickly.
Very, very, very quickly.
Yes. And for those reasons, I think we need to question whether these tactics and these techniques that at least are talked about in these memos are in fact appropriate under the circumstances.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Harry is calling from Louisville, Kentucky.
Good morning.
Good morning, Harry.
Thank you. I'm a retired military officer, Vietnam vet, and I believe that it's a slippery slope, and the end doesn't justify the means, and I'm afraid where this could go. We need to take the high road. It's better for us to fight and die and have losses than it is to compromise our principles and freedoms, no matter how they're documented or written or whatever. People know what they are, and they should support them. And I get very concerned about when I hear that we're compromising our principles in this way. And supported by our government, it appears to be, and I'm sure it is, really.
Okay. Harry, just stay with us. I just want to ask David, do you find it at all ironic that in this hour, in this conversation, that the people who are most concerned about adhering to the high road are from the military? and that no. It tends to be that civilians, both in the Defense Department, at the Justice Department, in the White House, are the ones who are saying, look, you know, we can do this.
Right. Well, I mean, if we had more time, I can tell you, with all due respect to my military friends, that the war is too important to be left to the generals and the instances. And there's an excellent book was published about a year ago by a good friend of mine by the name of Elliot Cohen, who is a professor who argues that strategic decisions, historically speaking, have always been made better by civilians than professional military officers. But let me reassure your last caller about one proposition. Nobody, at least certainly I'm not arguing in favor of inflicting pain and subjecting people to torture, because indeed, I said it three times by now, this is inconsistent with who we are. And I also agree with Scott, you don't get reliable information. But there are a lot of things between that extreme and doing absolutely nothing and asking people for rank, file, and serial number. Things like sleep deprivation, things like use of stress positions, things like restrictive diet, the kind of things actually we do to our own people as a part of both basic and advanced
but
training.
Is that all David, is that all that's going on? I mean, one of the thing that shocked about Abu Ghraib, and now as we find out more and more about what is permissible, that, you know, it isn't just sleep deprivation and it isn't these things. And again, I bring it back to the question of temporal. If you take someone off the battlefield and within 24 hours you're able to extract information, that will be of operational use. It will save lives of American soldiers. 3 years on, what of operational use can possibly be coming from Guantanamo, and is it not a form of psychological torture not to tell these guys that they're about to be charged, that they're going to have a lawyer, that they're going to face a judicial process on X date?
Michael, I'm not an expert in interrogation, thank God, but I can tell you that a number of people who are experts have indicated that we have decimated al-Qaeda infrastructure. Two-thirds of their senior people have been killed and arrested, largely, exclusively even, based upon interrogation information, because God knows we have not succeeded in penetrating these entities. I would tell you that a great many attacks against American soil have been stopped because of intelligence information. It's rare in life that both the moral and the practical imperatives, as some of our critics are suggesting, all point in the same direction. Let's admit to ourselves that interrogations do provide vital information, not all the time, but often enough. Let's also admit that we have to use some harsh techniques which do not rise to the level of torture,
David,
or inhumane treatment. Let
me quickly bring Scott in, and then I want to take one last call. Scott?
Well, I think the caller raised the fundamental point, which is, again, our national morality. If, in fact, we believe that we can use increasingly torturous type of techniques, not the lining up on the drill field, as David suggests, but those where there are long durations of sleep deprivation, 96 hours up to a week, then clearly I think we need to come to grips with where as a nation are we headed, or are we throwing out the fundamental principles that as a democracy we say we are a nation under the rule of law. I am concerned that at least the image that we are portraying overseas to even our closest allies is not that.
Harry, I want to thank you for your call. Deanna is calling from Elizabeth City, North Carolina.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm curious with this discussion about the actual enforceability of any kind of rule of law, in particular dealing with war, just as kind of a wimpy parallel, you might say, we have dietitians that say stay away from fast food places, yet America remains very overweight because it's in their system. If, as mentioned earlier, our military is trained to be able to endure and to subject themselves during their hell week to forms of torture, then how then are the laws and rules of war and the Geneva Convention enforced by these very people that have been trained exactly to the opposite?
Deanna, that's an excellent question. Let me throw it first to the former military man, Scott.
Michael, it is an excellent question, and I think your listeners need to know that going all the way back to World War II, there has been a history of enforcement and criminalizing of war crimes. We have it in international law. There is an international criminal court, which the United States does not agree with nor support. There are two ad hoc tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda that are pursuing exactly those type of charges. And the military is under its own uniform code of military justice, which, although it may not call it a war crime, clearly can prosecute, as we are seeing in Iraq, offenses of maltreatment of a prisoner. So they are enforced both domestically under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, in our federal courts under the War Crimes Act, Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act, and also in international tribunals.
David, do you want to respond to Deanna?
The only thing I should say that should make you feel much better about your country and your government, we have, despite occasional abuses and despite all this, unfortunately, in my opinion, overinflated criticisms, we have the best, the most rigorous, most compliant system. And again, to put things in perspective, we had individual abuses, we have some problems, we have enormous level of compliance for all aspects of the military and civilian. We have the Geneva Conventions, we're very careful how we use force, we minimize civilian casualties, we punish our own people. I mean, we're basically good guys. And not to lose that sense of proportion is enormously important.
But
losing it is just as bad as sweeping things under the rug.
I hope you don't think that this conversation has been losing proportion.
No, I don't. I'm not saying it at all, Michael. I think it is a very good and very useful conversation. But I do occasionally read articles where people are portraying the actions by this administration as, you know, we're lurching from one war crime to another. And frankly, ICRC, I think, has substantially compromised its traditional objectivity by basically being sometimes correct, but other times entirely over top, not just criticizing our treatment of detainees, but saying we used force excessively in Iraq. I mean, this has been the most discriminate and proportionate conflict in human history. We lost a lot of our own guys because we don't use force excessively in populated areas.
Scott?
I would only end with this comment, Michael, that I think the danger that I see is not that these people will not be prosecuted. I think David is exactly correct. We have a good history of compliance and a prosecution of those who do not. In these memos, I see the creation of a counterculture that runs against 50 years of those excellent military personnel who have served honorably and complied with international and domestic law. To suggest ways to avoid that very law is troubling to me.
Scott Silliman, thank you very much for joining us. Scott Silliman is professor of law at Duke University, the executive director of the Center on Law, Ethics, and National Security at Duke, and he's a retired colonel in the who spent 25 years as an Air Force judge advocate. And thank you, David Rifkin, for joining us. David Rifkin was in Washington, D.C. He's a partner at the law firm of Baker & Hostetler. He worked for the Reagan and first Bush administrations. Gentlemen, thank you very much for that calm, reasoned discussion. And if you want to look at the one memo that we've managed to that's managed to come out, in spite of John Ashcroft, you can go to our website, theconnection.org. The Connection is produced by Anne-Marie Dorning, Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Schugertz. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Michael Goldfarb, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.